From Noble Robot on East Hennepin Avenue in fresh-faced Minneapolis, this is Nice Games Club, the show where nice game devs talk games and game development.
I'm Lydia Simchich, and I make nice games.
I'm Stephen McGregor, and I make nice games.
And I'm Mark McRoy. I, too, make nice games. For this week's episode, our topics are incremental learning and making science fiction worlds. And so, if everyone's ready, let's start.
It's kind of weird because this is like actually the first episode we're recording since our winter break. We messed things up because calendar math is hard. You will have already heard us speaking about things for two weeks.
Yes.
Until now.
The mistake was, and we've probably described this, you probably will have already heard this.
Yeah.
But yes. Maybe you're not a listener every week, so maybe this is news to you.
Mm-hmm.
But also it's we want to tell far and wide, but yeah. We are now releasing episodes 1 week early on Patreon.
Yes.
Another little bonus, if you want to be a patron, you get a little bit of head start on what we're talking about, as well as those episodes being ad-free. Okay, end of ad for now. and so to do that and maintain our honesty in our hiatus intros where we said we'll be back at the end of February, we needed to actually get that going right away. And so we needed to record an episode before we come back. So, listener, you will have already heard what we did on our winter break. You will have already heard our tearful goodbyes to Ellen. I'm assuming we cried a lot.
Yeah.
It was very, a heartfelt and very special episode. And this is just a normal episode as far as you're concerned. But from where we're sitting, this is the first that we're sitting here with Lydia as our permanent host, the new trio.
Yeah.
And so we probably had a lot to say about that. Mm-hmm. And for us, we'll have much to say. Okay. It's awkward because we have a lot to talk about, but yes. That's coming for us later.
Yes, exactly.
You'll have heard all of what we did.
That's what's wild about
it. But one of the things that happened
is Civ 7 came out, yep. And I've been playing it too much. I'm actually quite tired today because
it might as well be night for you because you've been playing it.
I stayed up until 2 in the morning. three almost. Playing Civ 7 last night.
That's just the way it goes. It's Civ.
It's Civ. It's just kind of how it is.
Is it good, though?
That is an amazing question. After all of that context, that is an amazing question. Just because you played a game until 3 in the morning doesn't mean it's good. I do like it a lot. I'll keep it brief because we've talked about this before in the future, but for you in the past. Listen.
Yes, yes.
We're going to do a lot. We're going to do a whole Civ section. Seven section in there.
All right.
All right. Listener, you know more than better than we do, but...
But basically, I do like it. I just think that there's a lot of things that feel kind of underbaked.
That's right.
It's wild to me that the game feels like a direct response to Humankind.
Yeah.
Like, there's a lot of stuff that feels directly taken from Humankind and then changed to make it feel more Civ-like, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot about it that I do enjoy.
Nice. So, yeah. That's a good teaser for me as a person. That's very good.
Cool, yeah.
Cool.
For me, my main takeaway is that I really like how they've taken multiple systems that have been piled on since Civ 5.
Yeah.
That was part, they built out in Civ 6, then in those expansions, and they've turned them into one system in many instances.
Yeah.
And streamlined it. But my this is still early days, and everyone's complaining about the UI right now, so they haven't had a time to complain about anything else.
Yeah.
Which, yeah, it's bad, but like, what? Has it ever been good? Give him a break.
Never.
As I'm looking at a resource screen being like, this is the worst thing ever.
I know.
But like, give him a break. But I have a suspicion that Civ fans are going to hate how elegant a lot of this combined systems are.
Mm.
Because I like it a lot, and I feel like it speaks to me as a Civ player, but I'm like, I feel like I'm not, I'm like the, I'm a minority Civ player. I don't think everyone plays it the way I do.
This speaks to me as a niche person.
Yeah. So I'm kind of recognizing that. And I'm curious what will happen when those expansions come out and the patches and they add new features. Is like, are they gonna lose their nerve on some of that stuff? Or am I just wrong about it and it actually is just like they want it to be more fiddly and complicated and just didn't finish it in time.
Yeah.
Maybe that's what it is.
Mm-hmm.
But I appreciate a lot of how it feels. It feels like exactly the same game as Civ 6. It feels exactly the same.
Mm.
But it for me anyway.
Okay. Mm.
But the clicking around is just like less tedious.
That's true.
In a way that I really, really appreciate.
That's very true. I agree with that.
Yeah. And the ages are interesting, but I haven't made it all the way through a full game yet. Mm-hmm. And Steven, I know you've played a bunch of half games.
I have made through one game now.
Okay.
Whoa.
I lost.
Yeah. That'll do.
But the modern era is kind of weird. It basically feels like end game Civ, other Civs. Mm-hmm. Well, Civ 6, I guess, because it's really the only one I've played.
Yeah.
I don't know. I'll probably have better thoughts when I've had more sleep and a week.
That'll be good. I'm excited.
To remember what I was talking about.
Yeah. And Lydia, you're a huge fan of the franchise. You have not played it yet?
I have not played it yet. Yeah. I have the keys to get... I have the game. My husband and I... Well, Ian is currently playing Tales of Arise, and I'm knitting while watching them play. Mm-hmm. So that's our current games project. Mm-hmm. But then we have to do the shuffle of like, okay, which computers and / Steam Deck can run it and which can run it well. That's probably not going to happen for another few weeks. Yeah. So I will be perfectly primed and ready for our conversations. But when I was growing up, I had Civilization IV and Civilization IV Golden. And so in middle school, my perfect Sunday, if I didn't have any homework that I still had to do, was a cup of Aztec hot chocolate and a game of Civ 4.
Ah.
Absolutely perfect. And then I only started playing the later Civs because those were the copies that Ian had. And so what we would do is we would, first we did Hot Seat. And then what we, just to keep things going quicker, what we'd do is we would just both be playing as one civilization together in my favorite couch co-op for games that aren't actually meant to be couch co-op games.
Yeah.
Works also very nicely for Baba Is You.
Right.
Just saying.
Oh, I believe that for sure. Cool. Mm-hmm. So that's Civ.
Yeah.
At least briefly.
Yeah.
As brief as we could make it. I guess we wanted to put a brief note on GDC stuff.
Yeah. So when this episode comes out, and now it's there are two dates when it come out. So like we're gonna have, it's a whole new dimension of calendar math, people.
Yes.
But it's gonna be just before GDC. We do a GDC special every year. One, multiple, or all of us go to GDC every year. Mm-hmm. And in recent years, we've been going on press badges, which is a lovely privilege. But we always have to acknowledge every year that it's the GDC pass is not worth the multi-hundred dollars.
Right.
So like we don't need to feel too grateful.
Yeah.
But it is it's a privilege that we have that other people don't. And we've taken advantage, but it's still an expensive trip, and a lot of stuff's going on this spring. So it's very likely that we're not going this year.
Yeah.
For a lot, of the show has been being updated and changed, looking right at you, Lydia.
Mm-hmm.
And although that was probably the least disruptive of the things that have. It's just an easy thing because it's what listeners know.
Yeah, just blame me, the new kid.
Yep, yep. But maybe. But we'll definitely cover any news that comes out of the conference. There's something I'm working on that might have a presence there.
Ooh.
Which is like, it's way too, I'm sorry how teasing that is. That's not really fair. But, so I might want to go for that reason alone. Also, there's like a whole thing about like, you know what, maybe I have a bunch of Nintendo business cards. Like maybe I could get, you know, some meetings and see about Switch 2 dev kits, which I've just been like,
oh yeah,
I now have like I have publisher batch projects I'm working on now that I'm like, can we please bug them? Like,
yeah,
yeah.
In particular, the thing about the now, this is going to talk about Switch 2 for a moment. We might know more now than we do as we're sitting here, but the Joy-Cons are going to be mice now.
Whoa!
So it's going to be like there's going to be both of you know about this?
No,
they told me about it, but they have not confirmed it yet, so I'm still.
Oh no! They basically, I mean, it's all but.
I need.
You just
the
don't
butt.
Want the spoiler.
I need
of
the
it.
Butt.
It's so weird that you.
I think I'm just fed up with all the rumors that have been around the Switch 2, and I'm just not acknowledging them until Nintendo says it's.
Well, try this at home. Take a Joy-Con and turn it on its side where the lights and S buttons are, and put that on the ground, and then put your finger on the shoulder button and move it around like a mouse. It super works.
Oh sure,
yeah.
I can do that.
And the Switch 2 Joy-Cons are designed in a way that makes it a little more ergonomic. It's not going to be a Logitech, you know, ergonomic mouse, but
yeah.
And so they have a sensor in the spine of the thing, and the idea is that it would be great for PC ports, something like Civilization, but also the other thing, it's like when the Wii came out and everyone's like, gonna be perfect for first-person shooters. Like, imagine left Joy-Con in your left hand with the joystick, more control than WASD.
Yeah.
And then you have a mouse in your right hand.
That's
and
really,
that's something people do on PC. They take a controller in their left hand and use a mouse to kind of get, they
that's super neat.
That
well, because the thing is that I've been playing a lot of My Sims lately, because ever since I was in college, because we had a used game store in our college town, I've been on the hunt for a used copy of My Sims for the Wii, because I loved that game growing up. Loved it. And could not find a copy. It got re-released for Switch, And so Ian got it for me for Christmas, and I've been playing it. And the it is really interesting to see how it how the controls that are so Wii-centric don't actually port super nicely to Switch. It is clunky. It is a little clunky because the whole thing about the Wii, about My Sims is that you're making furniture and painting furniture and with these essences and things. And so you really do need that kind of, like, I keep getting the zoom in, zoom out and the actual move it, like rotational stuff and the fil- and the like switching through different things buttons mixed up.
Yeah.
So it, and even like the fishing minigame feels a little clunky and stuff. So it's been interesting to see how Wii to I always thought that Wii to Switch ported nicely because I've played other games that I know had those mechanics. Mm-hmm. It not entirely true. Yeah. I wonder if some of that is because they've started, you know, they've been remaking for Switch a lot from different hardware.
Yeah.
They're getting a really good sense of what the Switch does really well, what the Switch does really does not as well, and what is missing mechanically or physically in the hardware.
There's a bunch of Wii ports that try to replicate the pointer experience.
Yeah.
And but there's a saying in sort of there's precision and accuracy,
mm-hmm.
and the Wii is, I think I'm getting this right, it's accurate but not precise.
Yeah.
And the Switch is precise but not accurate.
Mm.
And so it's actually games that are designed expecting one or the other is kind of, it's not an easy one-to-one thing, although there have been some attempts to make that work, which is sort of strange. It's actually one of the reasons why the Wii didn't do great as a first-person shooter. Because you sort of wanted the opposite, actually. Mm-hmm. And that's, you know, the pointer experience. But in any case, the thing I'm excited about this for Switch 2 with this sort of mouse control is that both of the things I'm working on are very mouse-centric games that I am handling the Switch ports for.
And are kind of
showcases for this feature. And so I think there's a lot of the, you know, well, how much do they care? I think they're designing it for Metroid Prime 4 is what they're doing. But, you know, so I would love to just see if I can at least just get to the top of that list of indie developers that they contact when they start opening that up. Because that will happen. It might even happen soon. But they put out a message on their developer portal. So, hey, please don't ask us about this. Because they are getting, you know, obviously, you know, which is, of course, they're going to say that. But I think, like, you know, and I'm if I can just get a meeting and them just give me a timeline when we'll know more, that would be very helpful. Because it kind of plays into our release plans. Anyway, so that's a reason I might want to go to GDC, but all of it is like taking an expensive gamble because hotels are very pricey right now. We can still get there without it being the worst, but. You know, things could have been better. And a lot of it actually, to call out the organization a little bit, they were really late on getting us our passes. And so we kind of knew we would get them, but like, I'm not booking a plane until I know. Like, we don't have that kind of money. Like, as much as I would be doing, could do other things in San Francisco, make other connections and do things for the show. Book. I mean, we don't need a pass to do interviews.
Sure.
It's never been something we've needed to do. We want to squeeze every... you know, drop out of the lemon or whatever.
Yeah, it makes it more valuable, worth it to go.
Yeah.
So it's a little bit of a downer, but also, you know, it's a lot of work, a lot of effort, and there's something about me which is like, maybe this is not to the benefit of the listener, but it's like, be nice not to have to do it.
Yeah.
Actually.
Oh,
you know.
Boy, yeah.
But there's something about losing a streak, too. I've gone every year for 8 or 9
years. Oh, wow.
Well, the way I think of GDC episodes is they're all very different from one another.
Yeah, so this is kind of nice. Yeah.
Still part of that trend.
That's
so it doesn't feel like we're missing anything to
Yeah,
me.
Yeah. Yeah, we never settled on a format, and like each one works.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe we'll come up with something for that week.
Yeah.
Plus, if you did end up going, it'd be a fun show and tell. You could bring in all of your, anything that you find and just be like, and this I found here.
Yeah, exactly right. Mm-hmm. We did one where it was, I think it was maybe just me, but we did a remote. Where I was the remote guest. That worked out all right. Back then, what was that? I don't remember when that was, but all ancient history now.
Yeah.
Okay. Well. I mean, this is, forgive us, listener, we haven't been on the mic since November.
It's true. And also, we haven't talked to one another, I guess, since then.
in the universe of the show.
Yeah.
Yeah.
As far as you, listener, are concerned, we put ourselves into a, you know, a styrofoam pack box.
It does kind of feel like that. When we...
Yeah.
Yeah.
But now it's time to start the program.
Yes, yeah. Exactly.
So I've brought as my topic incremental learning. Because what is the advice that everyone always says if someone says, I want to get into making games, they say,
make a super tiny one.
Make a very small game. Yeah. How do you do that?
Right.
An excellent question.
Because, and I've been thinking a lot about this because I'm very bad at self-study. I'm very bad at self-motivated projects just across the board. If I have to learn something and it's just, and it's the, like, you need to research and do it when you don't have, when as a hobby after work hours, I'm not good at that.
Yeah.
Except for the fact that I have done it successfully once. After college, I knew I was going to have a vacuous space of time because finally I didn't have homework for the first time in my life. And I wanted to be able to fill it with something. So I decided, okay, I want to learn how to knit. My grandmother taught me knit stitch a while ago. And it's a fun thing I can do while watching TV or watching my husband play video games and just pick up, put down. And I successfully did that. And I really have been sitting down and trying to figure out, why did that work out so well? And how do I apply it to other things that I really want to learn how to do? Some crafts, like I want to learn how to sew my own clothes, but also I really want to be able to learn how to do that with video games because I want to learn how to be able to make more things hands-on. And as a game designer, one of the biggest weaknesses I have is that I can't rapidly prototype in Engine. I can make paper prototypes. I can make digital paper prototypes on like Google Slides or Mural or whatever. I can't do that in Engine.
Yeah.
And it's also overlaps kind of nicely with, in the same vein of like, there's clearly some tutorialization thinking that could be here too. You know, everyone points to Mario World 1, Stage 1 as, you know, the epitome of teaching you how to do things cumulatively. Mm-hmm. And can you do that with games? How would you go about doing that? With knitting, what I did is I had already known the knit stitch, so I had to kind of get that in my hand. But essentially, if you know knit and purl, you can do a bunch of other fun decorative patterns. Kind of think of like it's a bump versus a flat surface. And then you can do all sorts of fun repeating patterns. And rectangles are the easiest thing. So I made, the first project I did is I made a throw pillowcase. I just made a big ass rectangle. And I did knit and purl ad nauseum to make that rectangle. And then I had a thing at the end.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It was a big enough project. I got it solidly in my hands. So then the next thing I did, just knit stitch. I did another rectangle, a scarf, and I practiced increasing and decreasing. So I made like a nice zigzag garter stitch thing and continued with that project by project, incorporating one new thing that I needed to learn how to do to be able to do other things.
Yeah.
The other thing that's been frustrating for me personally is the difference between like tutorials and patterns.
Sure.
With patterns, you have like very clear steps, step one, step two, step three. You can also see the relationship between those steps because they literally build off of each other. Or there's a very clear, like, put that aside. We're going to work on this part now. That's a separate piece that will come together.
Yeah, yeah.
And you can just do that one thing. It's one pattern, one project. But there are so many patterns out there for the same types of projects, right? If you want a hat, you can go on Ravelry and find a bajillion different hats of any sort. And you can filter by, I want a hat with ear flaps. Cool. I want a hat with color work. Cool. You can do that. But with tutorials, it's always, it could be like one clone, but it's one, or it's one feature and everybody does it a different way.
Yeah.
And it's so dependent, right?
It's so interesting because the organization that we founded in the community, Nice Games Alliance, we're working on putting together a workshop series.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things we talked about is exactly that. Like, what is the function of tutorials and why do they work? When do they work and why do they don't?
Mm-hmm.
Most often, actually.
Yeah.
Right? And one of those things is that they're very much goal-oriented. You end up with the thing at the end. Whereas what you want when you do a tutorial is to learn something. And you want to have knowledge at the end.
Yeah.
You don't necessarily care as much, or if you do, you want it to have some value to you, the thing you come out at the end. And so that is really difficult when you say like, yeah, all the tutorials, they do things all the different ways. And then you just now know how to do it that way.
Mm-hmm.
But did you actually learn how to do it in a way that would, because the point is that you want to eventually do it and make your own choices.
Yeah, yeah.
It doesn't teach you that.
You learn how to do it, but not why to do it.
Yeah.
Yeah. But I think also sometimes they go a little too deep into the why too quickly because, yes, there is a good way to do something, but a good way to do something might not matter for what you need it for. Because the one that comes to mind is optimization and process and like doing things well, like doing things the right. Because you, for especially if you want to make a small game, you may not need optimization.
Yeah.
Another thing I just realized that is kind of weird about tutorials as opposed to patterns is that like you are only seeing one hat. Like it would be as if you are following a recipe and you only saw one sentence at a time of the recipe.
Right.
Because like with a recipe, you get the ingredients and then you can read through the process and then you can go back to step one and do that. Same with a pattern. You can be like, all right, if you are confused about why you're doing something immediately, you can go down and go, oh, it's because it's going to have to be eventually the shape.
Yeah.
That's really sometimes helpful, and that's at least enough of a why to then get you through the squidgy, what am I doing here? I'm trusting the process.
Yeah.
And so there are decisions that people are making to do things certain ways, like make a crosshairs a certain ways. They may not be the right decisions, and it also may be that you don't need to know those decisions, and it's hard to – you don't know enough to make those decisions yourself.
Yeah.
Right.
Or to determine what you can and can't ignore.
Yeah.
Yeah, game dev tutorials have this thing where they'll blow past this complicated thing that the tutorial is not about.
Yeah.
But you don't really know that when you're doing it.
Yeah.
You kind of don't totally understand. A much more effective way to learn game development is to learn how to use this thing. How to use this thing. And at the end, you don't know how to do anything else, but how do you add a collider and a rigid body and make you don't have anything. It doesn't get, you don't end up with something workable,
right.
Something you can be, and you don't get that dopamine hit of like satisfaction. You just know it's really just boring instruction. Then eventually you know all these, you know, mechanical parts.
Yeah.
Now you can build your thing.
Yeah.
And now you're ready to be taught like why you'd put them together because you don't have to do all these asides. Be like, click this, then that, then this, and add this, and drag that to there.
Yeah.
But don't do it this way because it will break. But I'm not going to tell you why because that's going to take forever. Mm. Like, you just already know that. And like, but that's not a practical. You can't start a tutorial assuming all that knowledge.
Yeah.
And you can't build a tutorial that has that all that stuff removed because then its value is really low.
Yeah.
So it is kind of a catch-22.
How do you learn how to draw something?
Practice.
Ooh.
You just practice? That's the only way?
No, there's ways of looking at, a lot of it is like a way that you learn how to look and see the shapes that make up something or the way, or you like to, you look at how light hits and moves. I see it kind of like, or at least from what little I know is you look at, you practice certain kind of lenses of looking.
Okay.
And so some of it could be form, some of it could be motion, and some of it could be the way light hits or light and shadow and highlight. Yeah. And then assumedly altogether that becomes drawing.
Well, I have a concrete example for you.
Okay.
Which is, you know, when you're young and you want to draw comic books, you tend to learn things like it with a bunch of rules, right? Like how do you draw a face?
Yeah.
And so this is just from when I was a kid, I remember like learning these things, and it still sticks with me, like little facts, which is like, okay, your ears, the start of your ears where they meet your head, it matches your eye line.
Yeah.
Oh.
That's not something you would assume.
Yeah.
Even though you have a lifetime of experience looking at people's faces.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
And then the bottom of the ear, like roughly hits the bottom of your nose.
Oh.
And there's just like, if you just know that, it's actually really easy to draw a face.
Yeah.
Like, even when you're bad at it. But that is information that can help you, that can save you time in repetition.
Yes.
But you're not going to get good at it unless you practice.
Right.
Right. And then also you could decide once you know that rule, like, well, I'm making a cartoon. So like, I'm going to draw it. I'm going to break those rules because I'm going to play more, not to realism, but to, and, but you need to know that you need to know
right,
the rules.
Right. Okay.
So I think that's how you, that's,
yeah.
I would say something like a craft. Because definitely game development is very much like a skill and a craft, and those things get mixed up a lot.
Yeah.
There's definitely like, oh, well, this system isn't very robust, but it's doing exactly what I want it to do.
Right, so that's
like, who cares if it's well-built, right? Like, you know.
Ultimately, as long as the game functions and can do the thing you want it to do, then that's fine.
Right, because you're not building a bridge.
Exactly. So that's why I was asking the question, is because I was curious how other art forms, how other
art forms. Well, that's why I said practice right away, because it is like, no amount of cataloging information or actually instruction is going to replace that.
Agreed.
At the same time, you could practice and get no formal training whatsoever, and you could get further than it was the opposite. Mm-hmm. But you do want both.
Yeah.
I think the thing that's really interesting and kind of coming up is the fact that the advice of make games is extremely bad in the sense that you don't, if you're making everything with a goal, you're not actually going to have any of that repetition. You're not going to necessarily have the, like, I am going to learn, like, I'm going to learn how a prefab, how to make a prefab and do it and be, and I'm going to make a bunch of prefabs and that is what solidifies it. You know, if you, there are still skills that I've done so many times when I'm knitting and crocheting, I forget every single time because I only have to do it once, right? Or at the very end of a project or beginning of a project or just for this one particular pattern.
I mean, I still have that issue and I've been making games for 10 years or whatever.
Yeah.
Well, that's why tutorials focus on the wrong things. They're like, you understand how to build this prefab or whatever. It's like, great, but you can always just look that up again.
Yeah.
You don't actually need to remember how to do it.
So, okay. So that's this part of the reason why I was asking about it is if our theory, I think we're all in agreement, that our theory is in order for people to get better at making games, in order for people to get better at doing anything art-related, you got to practice that. How do you practice that with video games? Video games are complicated because they require so many different disciplines in order to make something.
100%.
Right? Yeah. And so part of it is like you could compromise on like quality of certain things to learn what you want to learn or practice what you want to practice. Like if I wanted to make a game, I have no art skills whatsoever. I just make squares, I guess, and do that and then make a game and I could practice the game design or the programming aspect of it.
Mm-hmm.
But like even in those instances, like I might be practicing those kinds of things, but I think that like it's still the iteration time on games feels longer than most other crafts,
which is what game jams are for.
Yes,
right. One of the things that people definitely do the advice is to like make many small games, put them out on itch, and you'll get they're very practiced.
Mm-hmm.
And I think as much as I'm crowing about like yes, you practice is the only way.
Yeah,
I certainly that's not something I ever did.
Yeah,
like I don't have a bunch of small games out on itch. Like I don't even really advocate for that as a I'm curious to hear what listeners say, especially how it's benefited them.
Yeah.
Because everyone comes to it differently, so there's no wrong answer. But when I say practice, it's practicing the craft of doing it, right?
Yeah.
One of the things that people, especially when you professionalize a hobby, which is what happens, which is the path a lot of us take.
Yeah.
Is you can be satisfied with the, I made 12 projects this year. I put them out on itch. I participated in this many game jams. I'm getting better. Like, what is your goal exactly, right? Mm-hmm. Your goal is to be good at the tooling because that's something that's skills, right?
Mm-hmm.
But the craft is the what's it for? Why? Why are you doing it, right?
Yeah.
And like, you know, it's sort of for someone who is as old as me and who is very focused on process, sometimes you have to remind yourself that like, oh, right. The Beatles like didn't know what they were doing when they made their first album.
Yeah.
And like, you kind of just have to be like, oh, right. And a lot of people who, and sometimes the more experience you get, the less artistic you become. If you get really focused on, then you just become,
That's true.
Lots of musicians, you know, become really good at their specific guitar noodling.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't want to listen to a note of that. Right. That's all to taste. But what I mean to say is that like, they are separate things, right? If you're focused on, if you're thinking about career development, like, I want to get good at the tooling. I want to understand the concepts. I want to know the relationship between the departments. I want to recognize artistic things. It's not always just one or the other, right?
Yeah.
I want to recognize that this is used to express in this way so that I can be a great team player. I can get hired on a team. I can move fast.
Yeah.
I can be good at my work.
Right.
That is, I think, separate from what I think a lot of people pick up games or pick up tutorials in particular to learn to do, which is I want to get better at expressing myself.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I think the conflation of those things, because it's not always the same practices that get you better at one or the other.
It's true.
Right? Like if you're saying you're bad at art and so you're going to make some jam games with squares,
mm-hmm.
well, I mean, the recommendation, because everything is everything,
yeah.
the recommendation I would give to you is like, well, then make the squares the virtue of the project.
Right.
Don't have them stand in for something that will come in later because you're not making those decisions.
Yeah.
Now, that's kind of a solo dev piece of advice. Working on teams is a whole different story when you're slotting in people's
stuff
and sharing a vision.
Right.
But that's a whole other topic.
Right.
But at the same time, you are also not learning an art workflow. And maybe that's something you really want to know to work with artists.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so maybe you should be building something that where is, you know, that is a very much a stand-in and is designed to be slotted in so it can be iterated on with the participation of other people. But those are those two outcomes, those two directions for your project are teaching you how to do different things.
Okay, yes. But here's the thing. If it is very easy to be if you have skills in programming, it's very easy to say, I am bad at sound design. I'm going to compensate this way. I'm bad at, I don't know art, so I'm going to compensate in this way, and I'm going to own that. Mm-hmm. If you're good at art, or if you're good at sound, or if you're good at design, and you can't program, you don't have a game.
Yeah, you know, well, video game.
So,
well, that's the thing is,
specifically video game. If you can't program, you don't have a video game. At best, you might have a paper prototype that you could then hand to somebody. And so here's then the thing. If your goal is to make a small game and you don't know how to make a game in the sense of work in the editor, work, make code, and be able to produce something, what type of game of any size
do you make?
Yeah. What is small enough and simple enough that you can then, like, kind of, what is the scaffold of games for program and learning programming?
Sure. There's a parallel here. I just want to jump in because Steven Squares, right, is he's still drawing those squares. Yeah. So it's not that there's no art, right? It's just so the corollary is, well, all right, you're going to open up the, you do have to learn something, right?
Yes.
And maybe what that is you're not using any code. All you're doing is dragging in game objects to your scene, adding components that already exist, pre-made scripts for you that come with the engine, and you can build something out of that. And you actually can.
Yeah, or right? I mean, or you could use a simpler engine like RenPy or something.
Right. Mm-hmm. But then your job, then you have the same exact two choices.
Yes.
Which is, am I going to make something where my design is constrained by the tools that I have the ability to use? Or am I going to build something where it is either available to be improved upon, or I identify what I want it to do, and then I have to learn that thing.
Yeah. Mm.
And I think that's where tutorials, this is when we're talking about building a workshop series in the community here. This is one of the insights where we thought, when you learn something, it's so important that you learn it for a reason.
Yeah.
It doesn't really almost matter what it is exactly, as long as it's enough stuff.
Yeah.
Because games are so multidisciplinary, because there's so much going on, every game has 1% of game development in it. Right? Yeah. Like, there's so much you are not doing when you make the game you're making.
Yep.
So it actually kind of doesn't matter that much what you come out with.
Yeah.
And that's maybe overstating the case. But what you need is I really want a game where this happens or this feels this way.
Mm-hmm.
Your job then is to identify, what do I need to learn for that to happen? And you can get really narrow on that. You could be like, oh, I need to learn the animation system, because this character needs to turn around.
Yeah.
Mm.
And like, there, now you've got a task.
Uh-huh.
Because you have something, you can learn something in service of a goal you've already set.
Okay.
But that is really hard to formalize.
And then you get into the, where do I find, if I am more, realize, okay, I need to use the animator in Unity, then how am I going to go about learning it? I go to tutorials.
Yeah, yeah.
And then you go into that issue of, okay, but which one?
Well,
and
they become more useful at that point because they're much more narrowly focused, right? They're much more just like, here's where the buttons are and this is how it works. And you don't end up with a Pong clone at the end. You just end up with, like, this is how the animator works.
Well, that's part of what I was going to try to bring up, is that, like, I think that, like, you're right in that, like, in order for you to make a game, you kind of have to do a bit of everything. There has to be a little bit of art, there has to be a little bit of code, there has to be a little bit of such and such narrative, even an excuse to play it.
Yeah.
But
you have to want to do it also.
Yeah. And you have to want to do it. I mean, that's the case with anything you want to do. And so I think, like, part of it is also, you just have to recognize that, like, you're not good at this thing yet. So, like, you can just do something bad and that's fine. And specifically what I mean is, like, if you want to make a video game and you don't know how to code, you can use a simpler engine that doesn't, like, that does a lot of the code, quote unquote, code stuff for you.
Mm-hmm.
Or you can just, like, simplify the game design to make it work. I mean, this is kind of the stuff that Mark was saying too. Part of it is just, like, what you're doing doesn't have to be good. So as long as you're doing something and you're practicing,
right.
You don't have to focus on, like, the end result so much.
It is very difficult. I think that's 100% right.
Yeah.
I think it is also very difficult when you're in it.
Yes.
To be like, this is going to be bad and I'm going to be great with that. Like, you kind of have to just forget that part. You have to know that going in, but then don't worry about that. And then coming out, you could recognize, oh, this isn't that great.
Yeah.
But next time it'll be better because right. I've learned some stuff now. But while you're making it, it is a very defeatist idea.
Yeah.
To feel like this, you kind of have to be of two minds about it.
Yeah, yeah.
I think it might be different for different people.
So I can't speak to how everybody is using the word or the phrase to make small games in order to learn how to make games. But I think it is important that you make a lot of things. You try to do a lot of stuff.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And actually, now that I think about it, when people say make smaller games, it doesn't necessarily mean that you make a ton of really tiny games. You can make one big project and have that be a bunch of accumulative skills.
Yeah.
I mean, really, that's how I got started when we worked on Vengeance. I learned a ton of stuff for that.
Yeah.
And you didn't make 12 games over those years. You made one game and you came out with it like really well educated.
Okay. Yeah. So on that, let's go on that subject and on that idea. So when you're knitting and crocheting, traditionally what you would, if you were like learning from a bunch of grannies, what they would do is they'd have you make a dishcloth because that is a square.
Yeah.
The nice thing about a dishcloth is you can, as you get better, you can use it as a very small practice space to practice a stitch or practice working with a new type of yarn or anything. And if you have a bunch of squares, you could then sew them together to make a quilt. You can make, which is very much sounds like your type of project.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe how we close this out is give three little examples of essentially like a dishcloth sized
right
thing to work on that you can either have, then you can take as this is my game, or you can put that energy into this is a bigger project, or maybe this is a collection of mini games or something.
Yeah, that's a good metaphor to think, because I think it's really easy in games because everything is so, the weave, to continue the metaphor, between mm-hmm. the separate things is very permeable,
mm-hmm.
right? It's not, I think games are not a quilt of features.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that is usually, that kind of thinking is actually very difficult. But similarly, the reason you do that is not because, it's because that's a learning process.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
It's not because that's the best way to make a thing.
Yes.
No, right? Yeah.
And so I think if you have that idea with games going in, I think it's kind of seem like you're saying, like going in with an expectation and knowing that your goal is to learn, and you may end up with something that's a bit hodgepodgey, but has value.
Yes.
Yeah.
And so you don't need to like give up on the fact that you made something that has value, but the process by which you get there, let yourself do it as a patchwork.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So I like that. I like that example.
Yeah, let's come up with dishcloths that either could be dishcloths or could be quilts.
Yeah.
Or a scarf or some, whatever size you want them to be, or whatever combination of things make sense together.
Ooh, it's really tough to do for a game because like what we talk about, like a character controller, or what, you're making a trivia game? Like,
yeah,
there's not really like,
I think
universe is so big.
Think about it in the sense of what is something that is small enough mm-hmm. that you wouldn't want to or would need to learn, but that could get applied to so many other
things. What I was going to suggest, I would split things up into disciplines
mm-hmm.
And think of it as like make a little prototype of like the game that you maybe want to make, and then make a narrative and like put it in RenPy so that like you can understand the pacing and how this narrative would work in your fictional game that I guess doesn't exist or whatever.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. That you're patching together. And then like do some art and then implement that into a separate, even separate project from that.
Mm-hmm.
Like think of it in that way. And then like you're like, oh, I can do all of these things. Maybe I can try to fit them together in the one monster of a project.
Yeah.
I don't know if that's a good way of doing it, but that's how I'm imagining.
I think
it.
that's a very high level thinking about games.
That's true.
And I think mm-hmm. what Lydia is identifying is there's disciplines within game development which have their own traditions of education.
Yes.
And one of them that you don't is like the tooling workflow and the programming workflow.
Right.
Like you can learn computer science, it's not going to help you. Basically working the glue that holds it all together.
Yeah.
I think. So maybe I would say, if we focus on that, I would say like maybe one of the patches could be an input system.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Sure, yeah.
And then you can decide like, well, I don't know what my game's going to be, but I want to be able to recognize when I'm going left or right.
Yeah, yeah. Okay.
Well, like, maybe I want to build something that only handles keyboard controls and I just need to know how a key is pressed. Mm-hmm. Or maybe I want to do something that's more action-based and can use game pads or keyboards. And then you're like, all right, how do I build that?
Yeah.
And then you can build that. And then the result with that would be is on screen, something lights up when you hit a button.
Yeah.
That's one thing
that
you can then learn how to do that.
Yeah.
And then suddenly, now when you decide what game you're going to do, you don't need to worry about like how am I going to handle controls. I've learned that.
Yeah, because that's the thing is in the sense of it's a dishcloth, the way that you then could own it or dress it up or make it your own in the sense of like, oh, I went to Joann's and I bought this really pretty yarn and I I'm going to make something out of it because it makes me happy. Then it would be like you press a button, you get a silly meme, or it makes a sound effect, right, or yeah. it turns your it's a series of turning your favorite colors, and then you can just make a little rave by pressing your arrow keys. That would be the equivalent of, I found this really cute yarn. I don't know what to do with it. I'm going to learn how to make a dishcloth to use something with it.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, that's cool.
And it's a piece that you have that you can then set it aside, work on something else, and then you can stitch, put, you know, attach them to each other.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. But I mean, there are other examples like that, I guess. We could go through a bunch, but that's the kind of thing.
Yeah, that's the size of something that I'm looking for. Yeah.
That's basically what I was advocating, but you're right. I was doing it a little larger than I probably should have.
Yeah.
And what's, I think it's important about like breaking it out like that in terms of like functionality is then when you have to like, how do I do that? You're actually going to interact with many parts of a game engine.
Yes.
So whether it's Godot or Unity or Unreal or whatever, you're going to have to learn how to navigate the interface of the engine.
Yep.
You're going to have to learn a little about the API that's available. You're going to have to learn some tool in a menu, probably. Like, you're actually going to have to learn a bunch of different things. But because you know what you're making, like every step of the way, you're like, all right, I don't know how this connects to this. Now I can Google or I can ask somebody.
Yeah.
Or if a tutorial is made, that would be the next step in the tutorial. Like, where do I learn that part of it? And you're not just learning, like, here's how you write code in VS Code, because that actually isn't going to teach you how to do that. Because it's even within that little piece, you need to learn like six different things.
I do actually want to highlight, though, your point about, I think where you had Little Square was the narrative pacing.
Yeah.
Where, because that's different than game writing.
Yes.
But then the thing is like figuring out how it should be broken up is, I think, would be the next, it would then behold the next step of how do I make triggers in level design? Mm-hmm. Because if you have all of this text and you don't know how it's going to be broken up, then as you're learning level design, you're going to be like, well, but how is this going to link up to the thing that I wrote?
Yeah.
So I think like that small square of writing something up and then figuring out how is it broken up into smaller pieces, and then how is it communicated and in what kind of chunk way?
Yeah.
Then that then tells you, okay, is this a thing I need to pick up? Is this a thing that gets is this a story that gets played by walking in certain areas, which would then that would lead to give you a very, very small, another patchwork size piece that you could learn for level design or for programming.
Yeah.
So I think that specifically, like narrative pacing, is another really good size.
Yeah, it kind of just builds on itself in a way. Like you do this one little tiny thing, and you're like, oh, I can do this thing now. And so you use that skill to do something else.
Yeah, it's really hard to figure out where the building, what is a small enough unit that does have essentially is its own thing, but then is receptive to other things, right? When you have a Lego brick, how do you break it down to identify one brick? It's not a clear thing where the seams are.
Right.
Yeah, yeah. And I think that's ultimately the challenge for some, if you're trying to build a tutorial that's going to teach you how to make a thing like that, because you have to decide what of those little pieces are going to be included and how small are they going to be and how are they going to connect?
Yeah.
And then the person engaging with that educational content is like part of the point of what I think to do it well is to give that person some agency over how those things connect, how many there are, and how big they are.
Yeah.
And so like, oh boy, like it's challenging on both sides.
Yeah. I think my little patchwork square would be figuring out how much you can do with buttons in Unity or your game engine of choice. But if you have UI and you have a button, how many things can you do with them? Not like, because in the vein of something like, the game Don't Touch Anything. Mm-hmm. Do you know that one?
Yeah, yeah.
I've heard of that, yeah.
Yeah. Essentially, you're just standing at a control panel and there's buttons and other interactions. But how much can you do with buttons? How much can you chain a bit or a gag with buttons, or a dramatic like journey with just buttons?
That's a good, I mean, this is a little bit separate from the patchwork notion, but that's almost like a good first step towards implementing game design in a game engine, which is then you start dealing with, okay, now I can deal with branching solutions. Now I can understand with things that turn on and off, things that are conditional.
Yeah.
Like, and that's the language of programming, but that's also, in a lot of ways, the language of game design outcomes.
Yeah. I mean, as a designer, I always think of the design first, and it's extremely frustrating to me that I can't make the things that I want to make by myself, and yeah. I rely on other people.
Boy, I feel that so hard.
Yeah. And to an extent, I'm okay. I am okay with it being bad. It's just the thing is getting anything is so hard. And so yeah. I think, like, for me, because I come forward with a lot of the design, getting something and then seeing, having it be, well, what else can I do with it, is the thing that keeps me within one realm, right?
Yeah.
That'll then keep me in the realm of, okay, well, I have a button now. What do I do with it? And then that'll keep me focused on buttons, as opposed to if I was trying to make a UI-based game, if I was trying to recreate Don't Touch Anything or Don't Press the Button or whatever it's called, then I would be like, okay, I've got the button. Oh, God, I have so much left to do.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah.
And that's the difference for me, at least, of like trying to figure out what is small enough.
Yeah, I think I have a hard time sometimes when I talk with people who are specialists, because yeah. I am always thinking about implementation and interaction between different systems because I'm a multidisciplinarian. I mean, to imagine the disadvantage that gives me is that I will immediately like cordon off big notions because I'm always thinking about how it interacts with other stuff.
Yeah.
Just to give it its like fair due. But if I'm going to advocate for multidisciplinarianism is... When you say like you have this big design, to me I'm like, oh, that's perfect, because then you can just decide how it all works. Right, actually that's like, and then anything you don't know you can just figure out, and like, I mean, I guess because I sort of delight in self-learning, you know.
I'm so bad at it, and the thing is, for me, like as a designer, I understand enough about everything to be able to talk to my team, to be able to get a sense of how it is exactly that things are working, and also to get a sense of how much of a problem and how much of a lift some of these things are. What are the potential impacts? Yeah. And so for me, whatever multidisciplinary stuff that I have, it usually goes into a pessimistic place of, oh God, that's a lot. Because it is, oh God, that's a lot I'm asking of other people.
Yeah,
that's true. I guess my ultimate point is, when I face those things of like, oh, that's a heavy lift, I can either learn it or I can modify my design.
Yeah.
And I think you're probably not in a place where that feels like a good choice.
Yeah, I'm not in a place because if I modify my design, I get closer and closer to zero.
Yeah.
And it's trying to figure out what is a whole number that is absolutely the closest to zero. Because if I can get to that whole number, then I can make another whole number eventually, right? It's that kind of optimism that I'm looking for. And I think a lot of people might be looking for. It would be really interesting to hear how other people approach this or have approached this. It's also interesting with design. I feel like as a designer, a lot of my job is to help people feel on my team be a part of the design. That was something that my first boss really emphasized to me. Is everyone should be able to feel like they are actually part of the design process.
Right.
And
in part because they are, right?
Like, they are.
But just mechanically they are, even if they don't know it.
Exactly. Yep.
Even if you don't give them that credit, like, and you don't realize that influence.
Yeah.
Absolutely. So the more they know it, the better everyone can be at it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so it does make sense that coming from a position of, I have a craft, I can physically make a thing.
Yeah.
And then learning and feeling the artistry from that feels so natural.
Yeah.
It's really hard to go backwards from that, to have a sense of like, I know what I see in here, but have that like klutziness of being able to, and it is a humility. You have to have a lot of humility for it to be bad.
Yeah.
But figuring out, okay, where are my tools? What do I have those tools?
And it's not even as important that you know exactly how to do a thing, but you need to know how much can be done.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
So like, I think this is where I would say like everyone should do this, is learn a little about everything.
Yes.
Yeah, 100%. You need to know a little bit about
like that is, I think you hurt yourself when you don't. Like, I'm not going to damn you to a life of needing to know everything about everything, but like that way, so especially when you interface with other people who are experts, you know their language and you can also help them be more ambitious, right? Because a lot of times you'll find specialists in other fields be like, that's the top of my capacity. And you're like, is it? And you can challenge everybody to build more, right? Mm-hmm. But also, if you know a little bit, then you also know when you ask that if you're being ridiculous or not.
Yeah, that's...
Because sometimes you are being ridiculous and you need to know when that's true, or you need to be, when you have that discussion, you need to be able to understand, because you're like, well, I know 5% of this, so I kind of can see the path.
Yeah.
And I can see that point up there that I can't reach. You probably could, right? And then they'd be like, actually, yeah, I can, right?
Knowing if it is whether you're going to take it into this needs to be scoped down or I'm going to push you,
yeah.
knowing, having a sense of, is this a thing we should have a conversation about? Because it could be that big.
Yeah.
That a lot of, I always point to this XKCD comic where it's like, I want this app to be able to tell you if you're near a national park. And it's like, okay, that's GPS coordinates, whatever. It says, and see if, and determine if a photo you've taken has a bird. And it's like, I need 10 years in a research team. Right. That, if you have even the tiniest inkling of a sense to ask if this is the scenario of I need 10 years in a research team, you may be pleasantly surprised and go, no, that's actually really easy.
Yeah.
Or they will go, yeah, actually. And then you can have a conversation about it.
Yeah.
That makes it, that is so much nicer than you going forward and thinking, okay, this is possible. And then going, well, wait a second.
Yeah.
And then having, not only because being on that back foot when you're really creatively excited about something is a feels bad and can end up if things go very, very wrong, could cause resentment.
Yeah.
But also, so you are prepared to be flexible, mm-hmm. yeah. whether it's implementation wise, whether it's your self confidence wise, whether it's your design.
Yeah. I want to address something you said where you talk about like whether you decide whether something needs to be scoped down. And I think that's a production question.
Yeah.
I think that's less a design question because when there's a limit, we can't do this because of the tools or the capacities or the time. That starts as a production question. Mm. But when it comes back to you as a designer and you have to modify your design, mm-hmm. then your job isn't to scale back. Your job is to adapt, to make the best version of the thing I've come up with that fits the stuff that we can do. Mm-hmm. And the knowing what we can do is what we just discussed is the big part of it. But I think you can really tell when you play like a big AAA game, you're like, oh, I know what they were going for,
mm-hmm.
right? And it's like, well, if they had just went for what they could do, it would be better than this.
Yeah.
And I think that's definitely different from saying like, and I, having conversations with clients, it's very, you have to convince them when you tell them, oh no, we can't do that. You have to immediately pivot to, but what we can do
is such and such. Yeah.
Will actually achieve what you want in a different way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that is, I think this is where I like, that is always true.
Uh-huh.
And that is kind of independent of your capacity.
Yeah.
Because you've now changed the universe you live in.
Yeah.
You no longer live in the universe where you thought this, and this could happen. You now live in a different universe where this other thing and the third thing can happen.
Mm.
Well, now it's not just that you're changing your scaling back your design. That design is gone. Now you're now in a production sense, it's not, right? You're still mm-hmm. working with it. But now you have this other playground to play in that is different, not worse than the one you thought you had.
Yeah.
And I think that is a mindset, but also when you think of like different means that you have one artist instead of five who knows one style instead of 12, like you might feel that that's less. It is never less. It's just different. And when you come from another discipline, but particularly from design, your job is to leverage exactly what you have, not make do with what you have.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I think.
I can tell that you're an optimist and I'm a pessimist.
Yeah.
And I can also tell that, like, I can tell that I have this strong streak of like, oh God, client work. And I also am kind of having to think like a producer for this job.
Okay. So, Lydia, this is not your first time doing a call to action.
Nuh-uh.
Which is cool because
give us money.
Yeah, give us money, please. All right, so there are a couple things we want to talk about with respect to this. This is the Patreon call to action. This show costs money. We need money in order to get things to function. So please give us money, as Lydia mm-hmm. said. But also, we've added a new feature of Patreon content that Mark talked about at the top of the show. Episodes will be coming out on Patreon a week before they come out to the public. So in addition to getting ad-free episodes, you also get them a week earlier before everybody else. So you can feel really exclusive and fancy by talking about topics that the public has not seen yet. I mean, I don't think we're going to be like really private about what we're going to talk about, but you can hear everything in context, so it'll be more valuable.
Yeah. That is patreon.com/nicegamesclub. You can donate any amount to join the Patreon. And as we are going forward, we are figuring out what else we could put there.
Yeah, let us know what you would like to see from us on Patreon. This episode is on, so we might put a little bit of this stuff into the Patreon. We're not sure yet. You can go to patreon.com/nicegamesclub and listen to this show and other shows 1 week early.
Okay, I have a topic.
Woo!
As well. My topic is making science fiction worlds. The reason why I brought this up is because I made a movie last year, and it was supposed to be science fiction, and it wasn't because I ran out of time to write it. So, I mean, it was still technically a little science
fiction. Now, can we not do this topic and instead you just tell us all about your science fiction world?
No, I don't have enough content for that.
All right, fine.
Oh.
But basically, I assume we've linked to my movie on the website if we haven't yet.
Yeah,
it's on
it's been a little while now, but I think it was in maybe in our last episode last year.
Yeah.
You had just finished it.
Yes.
About it.
Yeah, yeah.
We put a link in there.
Yeah, so effectively a lot of the movie was supposed to be set in not the distant future, but a few years into the future, where like the Earth's, oh my gosh, I'm like forgetting the plot because it's been a little bit since I've watched it. But basically, they're trying to figure out ways to like to handle climate change, because the air has gotten a lot worse and like it's difficult for people to go outside and things like that. I didn't actually, in actual shooting, I forgot some of these details, and so like people weren't wearing masks when they were supposed to and stuff like that. But it's
fine. Yeah.
This is a school project.
Yeah.
Right.
Right.
So
right.
You have some leeway. You're not, for listeners who didn't know that, they're like, why did he make this thing?
Yeah. Yeah, I did it for a class.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And
it did turn out pretty good.
Thank you, Mark. It was very stressful. And so that kind of combines into how I feel about the movie.
Yeah.
Which I guess is probably the case with everything you make.
But especially for like school projects.
Yeah.
Because they have deadlines and you are graded on them.
And you're working on a group and sometimes it's not always, you know, it's working well and things like that. So anyways, I had came up with this idea. I was hoping that I could put like more sci-fi like sort of ideas into the movie.
Yeah.
Just like, yeah, I mean, the idea that, like, it's set a little bit in the future, but not too much in the future. And the idea is that, like, society has improved in the way that, like, everybody is optimistic about being able to solve climate change.
Oh, my God. Already that is fiction.
Yeah, I know. But, like, everybody feels optimistic about it. And that was kind of the world I wanted it to feel like. And I sort of, like, the movie has a hopeful, like, tinge on it, which is good. I think that came across.
Yeah.
But I wasn't really able to get a lot of the sci-fi aspects of
it. Well, a big part of it, and it's one of the reasons why we do science fiction at all.
Yeah.
Not every science fiction, but like the story wasn't about that
explicitly. Right.
Yeah. It was a personal drama with that as the backdrop informing it.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Right. Which is, I think, probably why you felt there wasn't a lot of space for that world building.
Yeah. Well, and I ran out of time and forgot about details when we started shooting.
All right. I'm giving you the benefit of the doubt, but
no, I won't allow it. I messed up, Mark. But basically, I wanted to bring up this topic. Well, I put this topic in as a roundtable topic I wanted to talk about before I started shooting because I was having a hard time actually like making it feel like real science fiction world.
Yeah.
So I want to talk about it now because it was a topic I came up with already and I wouldn't use that. But I think it's a fun topic.
Yeah.
So yeah, let's talk about that. Like what would it, how do you do it?
Okay.
I didn't do it yet.
So I think that I wanna kind of ask what flavor or ask a divergent. We're at a path. It's the fork in the road.
Yep.
Are you talking about how do you make sci-fi settings for story to happen, or how do you make a sci-fi centric story?
That is a great, that's a good distinction.
Because like,
yeah.
For example, it sounds like I really like what you had an idea for where it is a personal drama with a sci-fi setting. I think that's really neat and I think that's cool. And I think you could also argue that like very popular, what like sci-fi things are like that. So I would argue that maybe Horizon Zero Dawn, for example, is in that category.
Sure.
If you want to have, this is a sci-fi thing and sci-fi is the focus of the story.
Explicitly, the speculative fiction of it all is what you're like, trying to tell people.
The call to action, the why is today different, this is the thing that we need to do today is science fiction.
Those are very different questions.
Conceits.
I see.
Do you want to tackle one or the other? Because they're not dissimilar, but I think that they put more, like the intensity behind some of the questions that one would have on making that setting, some of them are going to be a lot more important and scary than others.
That's a very good question. I think I'll describe what I like from sci-fi things. Yeah. And I mean, this isn't just, I mean, it's my topic, but like y'all can talk about what you like about it too. Yeah. And then maybe that'll answer the question in the direction. I think I'm leaning towards less, it's like less hard sci-fi and more ideas around sci-fi, if that makes sense.
Like you want to build a sci-fi world where any sort of genre could happen in it.
Yeah, and I think what I like about sci-fi is that like you effectively think of a somewhat realistic depiction of the future,
yeah,
in which, you know, a bunch of decisions have changed so that this society works the way that it does.
Yeah.
And then you kind of have to explain that, not necessarily to the viewers, but like to yourself, so you know how to write it, right? And so that's kind of what I'm imagining. It's like, instead of it being like hard sci-fi, we're doing this stuff today. So mm-hmm. that's what it'll look like in 20 years, in 50 years, 100 years or whatever. I'm thinking of it in terms of what decisions led up to what this world I want to exist happen. Yeah.
Right. You want to start at, this is the story I want to tell.
Yes.
Now it's time to fill in so it feels plausible.
Yeah.
Right. I would say,
which people might give you crap about, but that is the way to do it.
It's just how fiction works.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
When you're doing, you know, magic and stuff, you come up with the way magic works so that it works in your fictional world. It's the same. Right. Yeah. Science fiction.
You have a goal in mind.
Science fiction can be the same way.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
It's just up to you how you want to do it.
As a person with a bachelor's in history.
Okay.
I think that you can look to history for a lot of these sorts of examples because essentially everything is building on top of itself. And in certain respects, the things that are problems either surfaced because always surfaced because there were previous problems and we had solutions to those problems. Mm-hmm. And also things can get taken to their extreme logical conclusion. So, for example, a very good science fiction world that maybe is not too fictional someday, but is BioShock, original BioShock.
Sure.
I personally haven't played it, so I am going off of what I know, but the idea being like, this is capitalism taken to its logical conclusion where it is considered a utopia and you have to pay for oxygen.
Mm.
If you take the concept of capitalism and you keep going with what ifs, okay, so this would happen, then how would people respond? So then maybe you would build this structure and how would people respond? You would do this structure. And it also includes undermining, right?
Yeah.
That would then lead you to some pretty ridiculous places. But that, and to the point where it feels unfamiliar and disconcerting or potentially hopeful, that is, I think, one way you could do it. You see this also in history. I think the classic example is in New York City, people had horses, which meant that they had a huge problem with like there was poop everywhere. There was a huge biohazard. Like just it was extremely unhealthy. There were dead horses rotting on the streets. It was extremely hot. You had to keep changing them out. Where were they going to live?
Yeah.
And so cars was a fantastic solution to that problem.
Yeah, it was a downright public health and animal cruelty solution.
And to an extent, environmental as well.
Yeah, yeah.
And the logical conclusion is everyone should have a car. Now, the thing is also what's interesting with history is that their logical conclusions for the future don't always pan out. I remember a utopian document I read in U.S. history class in high school where their vision was that everyone would eat in restaurants, like these public, essentially communal restaurant dining hall spaces.
Yeah.
And you could choose which one you wanted to go to, but no one ate in their own homes because everyone, and that was the thing, is eating at a restaurant was so hard to do. It was a luxury. So it was a fantastic, this is utopian. Everyone can eat in a restaurant every single day with their peers and their families.
It's freed from the burden of this enslaving in a kitchen.
Yeah, right? Exactly.
Because that was that was the sign of luxury. And then later, kitchens became a sign of like craft and hearth, seen as a burden.
And now people have so little time that now they eat out a lot.
Yeah.
They deliver, but then it also has its own ramifications. So I think like there, when it comes to sci-fi, there's what is the kind of the adding on, and remember society is self-complicating. How does it get added on, and what were the possibilities that got abandoned as well?
Yeah.
Because that tinges it either positively or negatively.
Yeah. I mean, the historical angle is, I think, really helpful, because a good way to learn like how speculative fiction, like how it ticks, is to look at something that is alternate history.
Yeah.
Because you have something to compare it to. And like that is usually also the opportunity for the laziest takes.
Mm-hmm.
But like it's a really good, it's good study material.
Yeah.
I think, you know, For All Mankind is the one I recommend because it's just really good. But it's the story of what happens if the Soviets won the space race,
mm-hmm.
made it to the moon first, mm-hmm. and you see like things would have happened differently, and you know it's one way they could have happened differently. but you start seeing how things could be better or worse. You're like, oh, it's interesting how, like, oh, we wouldn't have had an oil crisis in the 70s because all the NASA research that kept us going to the moon in the early 70s meant that people were ready for electric cars earlier. And so you had all this. But then at the same time, suddenly now you have an entire industry's out of work. And then you have more, you have homegrown social, you have like sort of homegrown terrorism because people, and because that moved too quickly.
Yeah.
And then because there's a culture war aspect to that, suddenly you have like social progress is slowed.
Yeah.
Even though life expectancy is longer and we've solved the energy crisis.
Yeah.
Like, that, who knows if it would really happen that way, but you start thinking how everything connects to each other.
Yeah.
And if you think of that from an alternate history, you understand, then you can see how it's threaded because you know what it's comparing it to. Developing your own world hundreds of years in the future in some alternate reality or just a completely fictional fantasy world, you do the same things.
Yeah.
You just don't have that baseline. But a lot of the same structure, like how did this happen? Why does it work this way and not this other way?
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know? I'd almost like be curious to do that sort of idea with a scientific attribute. So like, you know, we are like, for example, tardigrades can survive, thrive, reproduce in zero gravity, being bombarded by radiation. With that actual fact in mind, I think the way one could go into science fiction and is go, okay, what can you do with it?
Yeah.
Kind of going back to the previous one is like, okay, I made a cube jump. What can I do with it? What can you do with the fact that there are microorganisms that can survive the vacuum of space and thrive in the vacuum of space? What else could be out there?
Right.
Yeah.
You know, plants can produce energy. What can we do with that?
Yeah.
What could one do with that?
Yeah.
Are there plants that can produce other things or plant-like creatures that can produce other things in the same way, like with the same biomechanisms, but are a little different, where it can then, that's where I would argue like science fiction and fantasy can then blend.
Yeah.
But having it rooted with like, you know, science has systems that happen and are replicable in many other things and are a little bit different across different organisms. Finding some of those commonalities and taking them to their logical conclusions or taking them to slightly different fantastical conclusions.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's, I think, the fact
it is going to be really helpful because no matter how big your story is, it's still smaller than the history of the world. So it is sometimes very useful to come up with a premise
that you can
build out from.
Yeah, that's
so, like,
where
this world is very different, but what I'm going to talk about in my telling of this world is going to be at one of the ways it's different.
Yeah, that's where I started with.
Yeah.
I felt like that was, well, I mean, that's what I wanted to do, basically, is I just wanted to be able to imagine a world in which we were better.
Yeah.
And then kind of build out what it would look like to live in that kind of a world.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so that's kind of how I started. I am not good at history. So I don't have a lot of and I think that was part of what I was having a difficult time with when I was attempting to write some of this stuff. Is like, I don't know a lot about history, and I don't know a lot about how such and such led to such and such decisions, and all of these things are connected.
Well, I think you also made it hard for yourself because in a very admirable way, where something where humans are very bad about slow change.
Mm.
We're very good with quick action. That's why, like, you know, during the Los Angeles fires, people were turning away supplies because they had too much and they were like, take it somewhere else because we have too much. We can't store anything, right? Yeah. Because people are very generous and very good at quick action.
Yeah.
To find the right kind of problem where people could live with optimism and that something is doable and is being done, but not be inactive.
Yeah.
Very difficult.
Yeah.
You picked a hard one.
Well,
very admirably.
Yeah. Well, I focused on just being able to predict weather. Because I think it just focusing on one really specific thing means I didn't have to be like, oh, we're solving all of the world's problems.
No.
In one movie, 5 minutes long. Like, that's ridiculous. Yeah. So it was helpful for just to think of it in that way. Yeah, the scope of it, I think, helps put things into perspective.
Well, I think, like,
because then you only need to learn that little bit, right?
Yeah, and then if you're not focusing on, like, a world drama, but a personal drama, it may not be that the whole world is fixed, but, like, this particular community is enacting some policies, and they are seeing a genuine difference.
Yeah.
Like, oh, wow, we have electric cars in our community, or, like, electric buses in our community. When I blow my nose, it's not gray anymore.
Yeah.
That is a noticeable difference.
Mm-hmm.
A quality of life in a local area that then, you know, is something tangible.
Yeah.
And so kind of the focus of your own lens, it sounds really like you made a good decision of having it be very small and kind of a micro history, I guess.
I think that's, to an extent. I think that can, I tend to prefer stories to be more personal, because when they start becoming more grand, it starts becoming more difficult for me to think of it as, to relate to it, I guess, is a better way of saying it.
Yeah.
So like, I tend to think of it as like, you're living within this world, and there's people within this world, and how are they living in this world that you've crafted?
Yeah.
That's kind of, I think those are the kinds of stories that I would want to tell that are science fiction.
Yeah.
That kind of a thing. Versus thinking of it in terms of like the whole society. How is society, I guess, like for all mankind? I wouldn't want to write that.
Well, I think that one.
Maybe it gets more personal because I haven't seen it.
Well, that's the thing about that one in particular is that it's all about implications.
Sure.
Right. And so when you tell stories where people are at the center of your world, like, you know, heroes and presidents and stuff like that.
Yeah.
Then a lot of times the plot ends up boiling down to saving the world.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And rather, you know, because like based on some of the part of the premise or whatever, and it's just kind of how it goes. Mm-hmm. What I like about For All Mankind is that it finds a way to do it well, make it personal, and make the stakes relevant to the world without it just being like some threat to the world.
Yeah.
Anyway, for that example, but what that means, I think, is you think about the implications and you think about the goals that your characters have in the world, and why do those characters and this drama belong in that world and not some other world?
Yeah.
Because one of the things you'll definitely find when people will be very critical is like, well, why? What is the point of this science fiction world? You could have told this story somewhere else.
Mm. Yeah.
And that's getting more and more common because more and more stories in popular fiction tend to be all very similar. Like they sort of, because they're kind of trying to appeal to like the cross audiences, because either you go really niche or really broad, there's nothing in the between anymore.
Yeah.
And in between is where the magic is. Mm. But I will speak to Widget Satchel on this.
Oh, yeah.
Because this is an example.
That's true.
Listeners may know is that, and I did a lot of world building just on my own, like typing things out in a way that like doesn't impact the game that much, but is really important to me.
Yeah.
And in building that world. And so, okay, basic premise of Widget Satchel is you're a ferret on a space station, knocking stuff over.
Yep.
Yeah.
So like, all right, what kind of world could that be true in, right? So let's walk through each step, right? Okay, so it's got to be a big empty space station, right? Mm-hmm. Because it's a video game, it's a platformer, and they're all big empty spaces.
Yeah.
So how do we explain that? Well, it's a station that used to be something else, right? It used to have another purpose, and now it has a smaller crew.
Yeah.
Because you're not going to encounter any of the crew. You're encountering the service robots as enemies, right? Because you are escaped from your playpen and you don't get caught.
Yeah.
So that's all of those things, all of everything about Sprocket's experience builds the world, the requirements of that world.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, well, what kind of world would have a big space station out in the middle of nowhere that's mostly empty and it's a little janky?
Yeah.
Well, some sort of expedition service that would be a little bit, that would be a ramshackle and would be it would frequently repurpose its stuff. So I built out characters that when you read their logs, you realize, oh, this is what this station used to be. And it was repurposed because a new technology was developed. And so now it's a laboratory. And so now that's why there's just stuff all over the place.
Yeah,
because now it's just kind of there. We have this whole new method of travel. This station isn't needed anymore, but like we're not gonna throw it away.
Yeah.
And so, well, how would some future spacefaring humans, how would that work? Well, why wouldn't you repurpose it for other things? Well, we don't have a lot of conflict, so there's no aliens in this world.
Mm-hmm.
Because you can leave a big space station out with five people in charge and not worry about security implications.
Yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
So now our world has no aliens. So, all right, well then why are they even out there anyway? They're not looking for life. And it's like, well, they're definitely scientists. They're exploring, and they're going a little further past what makes sense. They're not. It's not so much daring as it is impatient.
Sure. Okay.
And so, what would be a society that's built on that? Well, let's walk backwards from it. Let's think about what the expedition is what I called it, the expedition.
Yeah.
And so I came up with a character who is the founder of the expedition, and I wrote their little dedication thing on what they would say.
Yeah.
So I have it right here.
Oh, okay.
And so all this comes from you're a ferret on a space station knocking stuff over.
Yeah.
It all leads to this.
Yeah.
Which is this speech that a character says. It says, "I do not prefer that the troubles of our past be carried into the stars. I imagined better for us and expected better also. But we do not realize our whole future in sequence, small futures each after the other. We must go anyway, blind and smiling, emissaries of wonder, explorers. On this day, at this place, together, we launch an expedition for which we are unprepared. Yet we are now even a collected peoples concerned of justice, looking in order to see our whole future ahead of us.
Ah,
right?
That's cool.
So that's big, and it's not funny.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Widget Satchel is a funny game.
Yes.
But it required, I felt it required that kind of background to be like, okay, well, humans went out into space. We don't even really know. There's not a lot of details here, right? There's many things left unsaid. But you know that you found like, oh, that is why there's this rust bucket out in the middle of nowhere trying to still make use of itself.
Yeah.
Right? That is why all the humans on board are in pretty good spirits, because this is what they're there to do.
Yeah.
It's not some backwater. They don't feel...
They're not stuck there.
They're not stuck there.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Right? They are, you know, they're emissaries of wonder.
Yeah.
And like all of that is, so that's the kind of future. So that says a lot about the humans in this world. Mm-hmm. And it all ties back into how it's like, well, of course you can bring a ferret on your space expedition.
Yeah.
Because like you need to be happy out there. And like this, yeah. And we're a people's concerned of justice. Like we're there to, so all of it ties together.
Okay. Yeah.
And it's all dependent and it's all contextual, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so I think those are the kinds of things that like, sometimes that's just for yourself to make things all stitch together. But and this is exactly the same in game design.
Mm-hmm.
Every choice you make impacts all the other choices you've made already.
Yeah.
Every new choice you make is informed by the choices you've made already.
Yeah.
And then when it's time to change things, then you have to realize how much of what you've already decided you got to throw out now.
Yeah.
Because it no longer fits the new direction.
Yeah.
But definitely when you're building a science fiction world, what you're saying, and I think this, for me anyway, a lot of this comes from Star Trek, which is that science fiction is about humanity. It's not about anything else.
Mm.
Now, you can have it be... In the specific, you're telling a story about a certain thing, and Widget Satchel is not a story about a certain thing in that way,
yeah.
Right? It doesn't tell a science fiction story.
Right.
But that world could play host to all sorts of other stories.
Yeah.
About, you know, what happens when Maggie discovers the new form of travel. Like why isn't she the one leading that program? Why is she back in the lab working on other things?
Yeah.
Like, what's that story about?
Mm-hmm.
Like, what's the deal, you know, with why do we have the policy that's in another log which says you can only take a certain amount of stuff with you when you have this big open space station? What is travel like in this world?
Yeah.
Well, we can tell a story about that. And we can tell a story about, like, how people get separated and what does that feel like and how do they think about their duty to the expedition and their joy in that expression versus maybe what they leave behind back home.
Mm-hmm.
Widget Satchel has none of that. But it's a world that could house those kinds of stories.
Right.
So when you think about world building, you want to think about it's built to tell the first story you tell.
Yeah.
This isn't always true. Sometimes you just build a world on its own. Mm-hmm. But a lot of times it's built to tell a story you're telling.
Yeah.
But the best of these worlds can house other stories. But they can all be thematically connected.
Yeah.
Right? There's definitely the kind of like, there are like shared fictional things online where people contribute all stories to like this one shared universe.
Oh yeah,
like SCP.
Right. And my criticism of that is that from a storyteller perspective, they can be anything.
Yeah.
And so they're nothing. But they have a lot of value in the participatory sense. So they should get all the credit they're owed for that.
Mm-hmm.
But in terms of cohesive worlds, it's one of the reasons why X-Files kind of falls apart when you binge it.
Yeah.
Because it doesn't really hang together.
It's just a bunch of random.
It's just a bunch. Yeah. It's like every story is true.
And stuff, yeah.
You know? And that's the premise of the X-Files, right?
Yeah.
But then maybe you build a world like that because that's what you actually do want. You have another goal in mind, right? You want to tell your theme. The theme of the X-Files is every crazy thing is true.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's kind of silly, but that is the theme. So that's the world they built to house that,
yeah.
Right? So I think a lot of it is about the story you're telling, but a lot of it is just about what are the underwriting themes, independent of whether you're telling a story about a small personal drama or a big sort of conflict or threat or event or something.
Mm-hmm.
That doesn't really change how you build your world necessarily.
Game pillars.
Yeah.
Talking about game
pillars. Basically I am, yeah.
Okay.
I mean, Steven, you know what we say on this program.
Everything is everything.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I want to circle back to see like how... What other lingering questions or problems you would have with this, especially when it comes to like how you would be incorporating, like where would the sci-fi kind of how would it be shown in the background or in the characters' lives or in the setting? You know, where would you add some of this? Is it clothing? Is it props? Is it whatever? And just kind of think about that. Because the other thing is, this is really hard to do. Essentially, the advice boils down to, like, be a very precocious toddler who keeps asking why.
Oh, yeah.
It's very hard to do that for yourself.
Yeah.
I do that. I am essentially the soundboard for one of my friends who does a lot of D&D stuff. And a lot, I am the one asking precocious questions off of his ideas.
Yeah.
Because it's so hard to do that for yourself.
Yeah.
Oh, and it's also very hard to decide what questions you're not going to answer.
Yeah.
I kind of think the worst world building, and this happens in D&D and role playing a lot, is when a DM will put tons and tons of effort into every single detail.
Yeah.
And then there's no room for flexibility.
Yeah.
You want to, it's like, if you got your themes down and you say what you want to say, it's not actually that important how many borders your fictional world has. You just know that there's one border that is in conflict right now, and that's what the story's about.
Yeah.
Once we can develop the story and talk about the other parts of the country later,
yeah,
or whatever.
Come up or something. Yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, which isn't to say that that's always going to be the answer for everybody. Sometimes you want to know all of that, mm-hmm. but then there are other things you don't want to know yet.
Right.
So leaving some things open is important.
That's a good question. Yeah.
So what's some of, in that vein, like, what are some of the questions that just for your movie you either asked earlier or wish that you had asked when you were making it?
Well, I guess I was thinking of it in terms of, like, if society made you feel so optimistic that you feel like you could solve all the world's problems, what kind of, I guess, like, where, what does that look like? Like, how do you live in that space? And what does that kind of encouragement look like? It's kind of what I was thinking of when I was trying to write it.
Yeah.
And so I was thinking of it in that way. I mean, I didn't have enough time to ask myself a lot of
questions. Exactly. Yeah.
Well, what I think that's what it is that gets the world to be that way,
yeah,
is a question, but yes. Maybe that's one you don't answer.
No, I think that is the question not to answer. I think the question is how in the levels of, you're saying, like, everybody.
Mm.
And there's individuals, but
yes.
Also there's systems,
yeah. Yes.
And organizations. Right. So, like, in the same vein of something I'm personally having to unlearn is the fact that if I don't recycle a water bottle, the world's not going to end.
Right.
Because corporations, if they actually did things, we would be in a lot better. Like, if they got to do stuff, we would be in a better sense because they are larger.
Yes.
They can exact more change.
Yeah.
And so in that vein, individuals does everyone feel this as a individual human? Are they doing this and organizing as on the company or town level? As a bunch of individuals,
yeah. Where are the projects housed, right?
Oh, that's a good
question. Do you line up at the administrator's office and sign up for one?
Yeah.
Do you make one of yourself?
Yeah.
What does the peer pressure look like amongst people? Like, what are you gonna do?
That's a good question, because, like, the main character of my movie puts a lot of pressure on herself to do well, and I'm wondering if society has, like, just put a lot of pressure on everybody
to be
upstanding citizens.
I think so, because the thing is there's also, you know, if someone said, hey, as a company or as an organization, we should do something.
Yeah.
If everyone is already doing the thing individually, then you're less likely to put in the effort to do that.
Yeah.
Potentially. And then that also adds new stressors, because my first thought was, like, okay, if everyone felt like they could solve the problem, I bet the patent office. Because everyone's inventing something that they think is going to help,
right,
and they want to get it out as fast as possible so it can help.
Yeah, what's the X prize here? Like, what are people actually aiming for? What are their motivations?
Yeah.
Is it that we have this unseen notion of betterment, like we have in Star Trek, for example, where you just take that as, like, well, that's just how it is. How we got there is
not
up to us to decide rather than the story. Or is it a case of, like, suddenly it turns out we actually, government has a lot of money and decided to direct it towards, you know, actually awarding prizes for social solutions.
Yeah.
Well, and that's the case. Then you have all this pressure on people. Is that pressure built up from a slow cultural understanding that that's a way to be a good person?
Mm-hmm.
And then how does that relate to the original motivation? And is there something maybe bad about that? Is maybe there's something that is not necessarily sinister, but maybe we, from a society that doesn't have those pressures necessarily, maybe we can see something about those people that's silly, but they don't realize it's silly.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Right? And one of those things might be, like, putting all that pressure on yourself.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, well, actually, everyone's on it. Like, you can take a break.
Yeah.
You know? Maybe that's part of it.
As a different facet, you could take this. Is the is the problem so specific that pressure and the onus, whether for everybody, companies, individuals, is this specific problem, we need a solution for this specific thing, and it has a very clear, like, okay, this is meant to be a, like, this is all a scientific issue. Like, yeah, we need a scientific solution. But because there's, and maybe that everybody as a collective and as an individual cares deeply about it. So there's not the like, oh, well, everyone else is doing this individually. I like us as a group doesn't have to. Mm-hmm. But because it is a specific need, if you don't have the skills to fulfill that need, then you put that pressure on yourself because, well, I don't know if I can contribute to the solution.
Yeah.
Is that where that pressure comes from? Maybe not for want of, you know, trying or wanting to, but the feeling of like, I can't.
Yeah.
Yeah. What's a story in this world where, like, about a juggler? People don't value that person's skills anymore because mm-hmm. it's not seen as important enough. What's that person's story?
Yeah.
Like, do they dedicate themselves to conforming to what is now valuable? And could you tell a positive story about that rather than a negative story?
Do they become so, like, I can help by making coffee and making sure that I keep the fridge stocked for the people who are actually round the clock solving the problem. And right, that is how I'm contributing. Am I, like, are they a janitor and they say, like, they are worrying about such a big thing, I'm going to make sure that they don't worry about their bathrooms or the electricity going off.
Is this a society that makes those people feel part of the solution? And what is your message to viewers as a storyteller? Mm-hmm. What are you telling people about their role in this society?
These are all excellent questions I should have asked myself 6 months ago.
But then you can see, kind of, depending on what the call to action is for the solution.
Yeah.
As optimistic as it is, the ways that could cause problems for someone, depending on what it is.
Right.
And the facets of how one finds their own place within the solution, because, you know, that is so heavily valued.
Yeah.
And if they can't see themselves as part of the solution, that sucks.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. I've started to realize recently that I enjoy stories and sort of want to write my own. Mm-hmm. So I might take some of these things into practice.
Yeah.
Yes.
And just ask myself questions about random things and see if I can
build
something out from
that. Or find someone to ask them too.
Yeah, because I'm not great. Well, I'm great at asking questions. I'm not great at answering them.
Yeah. It's a lot easier to answer questions if someone else is asking them.
Mm-hmm. I think that is the case.
And I think a lot of it is some form of context switching in your brain, where it's like, I've worked with people who are both good developers and good designers.
Yeah.
But if they're in development mode, they have to ask, and they have an engineering question of like, how should this work?
Yeah.
They can't. They need another designer to answer it for them because they can't, like, put that brain down, pick up their design brain, think about it again, and then put that design brain down and pull their engineering brain back on. Yep. That takes time.
I think I'm kind of that way with something.
It's a different, it is a very, like, quick context switch.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Cool. Thank y'all. This is great. I can't promise I'm going to actually write anything, but I want to. So I'm
when's the book signing?
No, don't do that.
Book signing.
Oh,
goodness.
We are making a small knit square.
Right.
We're starting with a square, a dishcloth, and then we can get to a quilt if we have enough of them.
I'll write a paragraph, fine, maybe, then.
Yeah.
That'll be a paragraph signing.
Yeah. make a dedication.
Yeah.
I mean, we're yucking it up at the end of the show, but that's actually a pretty good exercise, is see if you can write a paragraph that delivers that theme.
Yeah.
Like, see how small can you say what you want to say?
Yeah. That's mm-hmm. Yeah, that's good. I like that.
You can build from there.
But now I have homework.
Yeah. Oh, well, never mind then.
Okay.
That's our show. For show notes and links on today's topics, go to our website, nicegames.club. Hey, if you didn't hear already, Nice Games Club is on Patreon. Support the show and get stuff, including ad-free episodes delivered to you a week early. Sign up at patreon.com/nicegamesclub. If you want to keep things more casual, you can always just stop by nicegames.club/discord and say hello to us and all of your fellow listeners. So, until we start again, remember to
play nice
and make nice.